FIFA says yes to the status quo. This is the world. I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman. Soccer's governing body responds to this week's arrests of its officials by re-electing its embattled president, Sepp Blatter. We'll explore how or even if FIFA can reform itself. Also, bee lovers rejoice. Pollinators are set to get their own protected corridor stretching from Canada to Mexico.
Wild bees that we know are threatened with extinction, and extinction is forever. Once they're gone, they're gone.
And a filmmaker goes to Israel and is in the middle of a feel-good documentary about a well-known bar. Then, on his last night there,
a suicide bomber came up, and after yelling Allahu Akbar, he blew himself up.
Those stories are ahead here on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. Breaking news, ladies and gentlemen, he won. Sepp Blatter, I mean, president of World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, the guy who is up for re-election today despite a massive corruption scandal that's engulfed the organization under his watch. And this was his message to the 209 FIFA delegates who voted in the presidential poll today.
I like you. I like my job, and I like to be with you. I'm not perfect. Nobody is perfect. But we will do a good job together, I'm sure. So I thank you so much. I thank you for the trust and confidence. Trust and confidence. Together we go. Let's go, FIFA. Let's go, FIFA. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
And we like the world soccer guy, William Troop. He's here to fill us in on what went down today in Zurich. William, how did Sepp Blatter get reelected?
I know, right? It seems incredible. The guy who's been in charge for 17 years, leading FIFA to its greatest crisis ever, just got reelected. And it basically came down to simple math. There was a vote held, 209 delegations representing soccer federations from around the globe, 133 voted for Blatter, only 73 voted for his only challenger, Prince Ali bin Al Hussein of Jordan, after which the Jordanian prince decided to withdraw from the race, and that was it. Sepp Blatter was reelected.
So even after all these corruption allegations, all the shame that's allegedly been brought down on world soccer, a majority of FIFA delegates voted for Blatter. What is up with that?
You have to understand how FIFA works. And I'm not talking about corruption. I'm talking about FIFA makes upwards of $5 billion every 4 years, mostly from TV and marketing rights for the World Cup. And then FIFA redistributes that money to soccer organizations all over the world for what they call football development projects. That means like building stadiums, developing programs to allow people to play more soccer. That is basically used as a patronage system by which Sepp Blatter and other officials at FIFA gain the support of all the people who are members of FIFA. And you hear that directly from the delegates. This is what Randy Harris, the guy who leads the Barbados Soccer Federation, said.
Sepp Blatter has really instituted policies to assist developing nations such as us. And we think that if you have an uncle who is going to assist you to have your home in order, that we should reciprocate when the time comes to give him some assistance.
I mean, there you have it pretty clear. If that's not patronage, I don't know what is.
Yeah, Sepp Blatter has denied knowing about any of the corruption whatsoever. He's blamed it on a few bad apples at FIFA, right? Has he even acknowledged that there are problems?
Yes, he has, actually. The question is whether he means it. Even before the vote today, he was saying that he knows that what happened earlier this week with the arrest of several of his top lieutenants means, demands, actually, is the word he used, demands action from everyone at FIFA to change things around. And today, after the vote, this is what he said.
I take the responsibility to bring back FIFA, and I'm convinced we can do it. And I promise you, in the end of my term, I will give this FIFA to my successor in a very, very strong, strong position.
So, William, I'm really wondering whether there's actually been any damage to FIFA at all. The organization seems pretty bulletproof.
Well, it can seem that way at times when FIFA just goes about its business as normal as it did today. But I think if the reputation of FIFA wasn't stained before by corruption allegations, it most certainly is after this week. And the one thing I do see changing is the attitude of major sponsors involved with the World Cup. Companies like Visa, Coca-Cola, Budweiser, they've all come out after the arrests earlier this week with statements saying this is really concerning and we are going to reassess our sponsorships unless you change things and you change those things fast. And that, I think, is where the real pressure is going to come on Sepp Blatter to actually deliver on the things he's saying over the next 4 years.
Okay, William, we'll leave it there. Thank you.
You're welcome.
The world soccer guy, William Troop. Re-elected FIFA president Sepp Blatter hasn't been charged with any crimes, but former FIFA vice president Jack Warner has. He's a politician in his native Trinidad and Tobago. The U.S. indictment unsealed this week charges Warner with conspiracy to defraud and racketeering, among other things. It also says Warner accepted a $10 million bribe in exchange for agreeing to let South Africa host the 2010 World Cup. He denies all that. Here's Warner talking to our colleagues at the BBC.
I have never accepted a bribe.
Never in your life?
I have never accepted a
bribe. Not even something that someone might think is a bribe?
No, I don't want people to think. I can speculate what people think.
Lasana Liburd is a sports writer in Trinidad and Tobago, and he's written extensively about Jack Warner.
I think Warner is a salesman, first and foremost. He's a charismatic person in that he's someone who could make himself at home in any crowd, whether the rich and powerful or the guy on the street. He has that way about him. I've also found that any relationship that Warner had over the years, they always end up in tears, usually by his partners. And you know, that's been the way he has operated. I do think that he is, I guess we could probably say, deluded based on his public statements, although, like I said, he's a salesman. I don't think he believes half the things he says.
Jack Warner also went after you, didn't he? He wasn't very happy with what you were writing.
Yes. In 2006, especially, Trinidad had just qualified for the World Cup, and Warner diverted our entire ticket allocation to his family business. He sold ticket packages that were worth 8,000 TT. He sold them for 30,000 TT. The tagline was "Ticket or leave it."
And Tobago dollars is what that is.
Yeah. And I unearthed the fact that it was a family-owned company at the time, which wasn't known. And you know, I really went after that. I did a three-part series, and his response was, well, obviously to try to have me banned from covering the World Cup, which FIFA eventually overturned. He slandered me in terms of my supposed motivation for the story. He claimed that the facts were wrong. He tried to have me fired, you know, but he really wasn't successful at all in damaging me, I would say.
So I wonder how you feel now that he's been charged with corruption and other things. And do you think he will ever end up facing trial?
I think he will. For all his bravado, I think he's almost out of tricks. Last night in his political meeting, he claimed that he is going to release all the bits of information he has on the Prime Minister, Kamala Poussart-Processor. We have seen that strategy before when he promised a tsunami against Sepp Blatter. But I do think he will be extradited once he spent a couple million dollars in legal fees. How I feel about the whole thing, I would say I have mixed feelings about it. It's great that he may finally account for his time as CONCACAF president. At the same time, I think he has done so many suspicious things in Trinidad dating back to 1989. And it's a pity that our own police and so on never laid a glove on him, essentially. So I'm a little bit disappointed that in the end we had to wait for the U.S. essentially to clean up our mess.
Is soccer a big deal in Trinidad?
Soccer, or as we say here, football, it's definitely a big deal. Definitely a big deal. There's been a bit of a emotional rift, I would say, between football fans and the national football team here, you know, based on all the administrative issues and corruption and so on. And a lot of fans don't see the national team as belonging to them anymore.
Lasana Liburd is a soccer writer in Trinidad and Tobago. His website is called wired868.com. Lasana, thank you for speaking with us today.
Okay, my pleasure.
The U.S. Justice Department is going after corruption at FIFA using RICO, the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act. That's the law passed by the U.S. Congress in 1970 to go after the mafia. In fact, it was used to convict John Gotti, the boss of the Gambino crime family in New York. So how is it that a U.S. law aimed at mobsters in the U.S. is now being applied to soccer officials, both American and foreign? To answer that, we called up criminal defense lawyer and Fordham University law professor Ronald Fischetti.
It's an expansive statute. All you have to have is an enterprise. The enterprise is FIFA, and individuals who are associated with that enterprise, and those are the defendants, who commit a pattern of criminal acts, which are mail fraud, money laundering, things of that nature, that are related to the enterprise and each other. So the statute itself fits this type of crime, although it wasn't normally passed for this. It's been used now extensively for other crimes that really have nothing to do with organized crime.
If a defendant is in a foreign country, do all countries accept U.S. jurisdiction here?
Yes, they accept the fact that we have jurisdiction for this, but whether or not they will be extradited to our country is simply another matter. Sometimes countries don't extradite. Of course, the crimes are not the crimes that they would be prosecuted for in that country, such as tax evasion is not a crime in Switzerland, so you can't extradite someone who commits tax evasion in the United States to be brought back here to the United States. And then it's up to the country to decide.
Do you think there's a higher bar for the U.S. Justice Department to get over because these people are foreign nationals, or is RICO enough?
I don't know. I can't answer that. There will be many motions that are made that RICO does not apply to this type of crime because everyone is in another jurisdiction and it's too much of a reach to bring them back here. So there'll be many, many motions with regard to this. And one thing I could say, anyone, you know, who is representing these people had better be an expert in RICO. It's a complex statute.
Have you represented any cases that were brought under this RICO statute?
Yes, several. Several.
Aside from be prepared, what would you tell these lawyers?
The first thing you've got to do is determine who's going to go to trial where. But it's very difficult to say what you'll do now because we don't have any of the discovery in the case. As an example, I don't know if there are any wiretaps in this case or consensual conversations. We know that there are three cooperators. Interestingly, we have two sons that are cooperating against their father. So that's an interesting situation. But you really can't parse them out until you get the discovery of what the Justice Department did in this case over the last 3 years.
As you suggested, RICO has been used in recent years in many different ways, even, I think, to go after terrorists, right?
Yes, it has. And these are people that are in foreign jurisdictions, never set foot here, but they've used bank accounts, perhaps, or a telephone call to somebody here. And we say that gives us a nexus. So we indict first and then try and get them extradited to our country. And we've been very successful.
So, Mr. Fischetti, do you think FIFA is kind of like the mafia?
No, not at all. Not at all. The organization, as I said, doesn't have to be involved in any type of criminal activity itself. It's only the members. You note, in the indictment itself, they don't charge FIFA as an organization, which they could have. They didn't. As far as criminal activity is concerned, they're okay. They're home free. There will be other indictments. There's no question about that. They've now revealed that they have three cooperators. They're going to continue their investigation. So I think you'll be seeing other indictments coming on in the next few months, in my opinion.
Ronald Fischetti, criminal defense lawyer and professor of law at Fordham University in New York City. Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Coming up, things haven't been going terribly well lately for bees, but they got some good news last week from President Obama. We'll hear about the new Bee Habitat Corridor here on The World. I'm Aaron Schachter, and you're tuned to The World. Imagine a world without bees. It's probably not a place you want to live. Sure, there's the occasional sting, but the upside of bees is so much higher than the downside. Bees help bring us flowers, and they also help bring us our food. But they're also in big trouble for a lot of reasons, which is why President Obama announced a plan last week to help restore populations of bees and butterflies across North America. The plan's centerpiece is a proposed bee habitat corridor along the I-35 freeway that runs from Texas to Duluth, Minnesota. And Duluth is where producer Catherine Winter lives and keeps bees. We asked her to check in with some other bee enthusiasts to see what they think about the president's idea.
One thing about keeping bees is you wind up meeting a lot of other beekeepers. They come from all walks of life. My friend John Otis is a firefighter.
And they're looking really good.
He let me look into one of his hives with him on the shore of Lake Superior.
No, the queen was marked with a little blue dot, so if we happen to see... There she is. Yep, right there.
Some of us beekeepers do it for the honey, or just because bees are so fascinating. And some of us want to do something to help pollinators. We keep hearing that one out of every three bites of food we eat wouldn't exist if it weren't for a pollinator. So John Otis likes the president's proposal to create bee habitat along I-35. That's the freeway from Texas that ends a couple of blocks from here. He'd like to see landowners and the government put in flowering plants in a lot of places so bees have nectar and pollen to eat.
Say if a city is going to build a new library or a new fire station or something, that project should include, rather than putting sod down, putting down native plants. I think that's an outstanding way to start.
John Otis isn't just worried about his honeybees. He's concerned about other pollinators, too. So are researchers.
My name is Elaine Evans. I'm at the University of Minnesota. I'm a PhD student in the bee lab in the entomology department.
Evans studies wild bees. Worldwide, there are 20,000 different species of wild bees.
People are generally familiar with the bumblebees because they're really big and fuzzy and pretty easy to notice. But a lot of these other bees are pretty small, not always really noticeable until you really stop and look.
That's what Evans is doing today, looking for bees. She's about 3 hours south of Duluth in a grassy field dotted with oak trees. She's got a clipboard and a net. There are pencils stuck into her hat band.
I think I see a bee here. Oh, sorry.
Did I scare it away?
It flew off.
Researchers want to know whether wild bees are facing declines like honeybees are. It's hard to know because they aren't sure how many wild bees there were years ago. But Evans says where there are historical records, it's clear some species are declining all over the world. And we need those wild bees. There are other pollinators. Wasps and flies and even lizards and mammals move pollen around. But Evans says bees are by far the most important pollinators, especially wild bees.
Globally, they're contributing as much or more to the pollination of crops as honeybees are.
Evans says honeybees aren't in danger of extinction, but some wild bees clearly are, like the Franklin's bumblebee, native to western North America.
It hasn't been seen for several years. There's ongoing surveys. So there's bees, wild bees, that we know are threatened with extinction. And you know, extinction is forever. Once they're gone, they're gone.
And that could also mean the end of some plant species that depend on specialist bees. Evans says wild bees face a lot of the same threats as honeybees, diseases, pesticides, and especially habitat loss. Wild lands are disappearing as cities expand, and farmers are putting more land into crops and spraying herbicides that kill the flowers bees need. The White House plan disappointed some people who wanted immediate curbs on pesticide use. But many people who are worried about pollinators were delighted by the plan's focus on creating habitat for bees and for butterflies. Back up in Duluth, a few blocks from John Otis's beehive, I found Dan Schutte outside weeding.
Likewise, good to see you too.
He's a beekeeper, but he's also trying to help monarch butterflies. He planted milkweed in his yard because it's the only plant monarch caterpillars eat. As soon as he put the plants out, monarchs showed up.
You could watch them lay the eggs, and we'd go over and actually grab that leaf because it would have, you know, 8 or 10 eggs on it, and we built a rearing cage for them. We raised about 90 butterflies and let them go.
Monarchs migrate across North America between Mexico and Canada, and herbicides have wiped out much of the milkweed along the way. Now the butterflies' numbers are crashing.
This is little blue stem.
A few years ago, Schutte and his wife tore out the grass in front of their house and put in native plants.
And when the seedlings were small, I think it still looked a little scraggly and people were probably, you know, just a little skeptical about what was going on here because it didn't look good. But by that third year, we had people sitting down on the sidewalk with their kids watching butterflies.
Now, three of Shudi's neighbors have decided to do the same thing. So soon, the street will have a corridor of native plants. Dan Shudi hopes the new White House pollinator plan will have the same effect. It's not enough, by itself, to solve the problem of disappearing pollinators. But the idea might spread to enough places to make a difference. For The World, I'm Catherine Winter, Duluth, Minnesota.
Perhaps nothing says spring in America more than this. Ah, the pomp and circumstance of sweaty American graduations. Funny thing is, that tune and its history are thoroughly British. And there are words. Who knew? English composer Edward Elgar wrote the music for The Pomp and Circumstance, March No. 1, in 1901 in London. The title comes from Act 3 of Othello, which I shan't read to you, though you know I want to. Lyrics were added for the 1902 coronation of King Edward VII, and the piece became known as Land of Hope and Glory. In 1905, Elgar received an honorary doctorate of music at Yale, and in his honor, the university orchestra played his piece. Graduates and guests loved it, and now we're all stuck with it. Not that it's a bad piece of music to be stuck with. As you can read on the Elgar Society's website, the tune manages to sound triumphant, but with an underlying quality of nostalgia, making it perfectly suited to a commencement that marks the end of one stage of life and the beginning of another. Couldn't have said it better myself. That's the BBC Orchestra's version of Pomp and Circumstance. Good luck, graduates, and remember, always wear sunscreen. Monday on The World, music of a different sort. Sylvie Boisel called every library in New York City offering to perform her Edith Piaf repertoire for free. She loves Piaf, thinks Americans will too, when she performs her Edith Piaf tribute.
When you listen to her, her voice reaches your heart. It's deeply your heart. She was a singer of the people. It's for why I want to reach the people.
And she must really want to reach people because she's planning to do her Piaf show at New York City subway stops.
And I want that every people can listen to Edith Piaf without paying if they cannot pay.
On Monday, next stop, Grand Central Station, audition day for the newest batch of official New York subway musicians. You're listening to The World. I'm Aaron Schachter. As a young child, Joey Alexander just tinkered with American jazz.
When I was 7, I got serious.
Now he's 11 and getting ready to play the Newport Jazz Festival.
You know, I think jazz is for everyone, even for kids.
You'll be amazed by this kid, an Indonesian wunderkind, ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. 28-year-old Omar Khadr is living in Canada, the country where he was born, but he's really starting a new life. Khadr was shot and captured by U.S. forces in Afghanistan back in 2002. He was just 15 at the time, and he'd taken part in a firefight that left an American soldier dead. Soon, Khadr was transferred to Guantanamo, the youngest terrorism suspect held there by U.S. forces. He ended up spending more than a decade there. Eventually, he was sentenced to 8 years in jail for war crimes and transferred to Canada to serve his sentence. But earlier this month, a court in Canada ordered his release on bail, and Omar Khadr spoke to the Canadian public for the first time.
I will prove to them that I'm more than what they thought of me, and I'll prove to them that I'm a good person. I believe in learning. I didn't have a lot of experience in life, and I'm excited to start.
Someone with a unique perspective on Omar Khadr is Michelle Shepherd. As the national security correspondent for the Toronto Star, Michelle, you've been following his case for years, and you helped produce a new documentary about Khadr's new life as a free man. I imagine many people were surprised when they heard this guy's voice for the first time. He sounded pretty calm, cool, and collected, and still has a bit of a Canadian accent.
Yeah, that was exactly the reaction. People were quite shocked at how articulate he was, seemingly serene. Omar Khadr in Canada especially has existed really as a caricature for so many years. And so I think for people to really just hear from him, it was really shocking.
Yeah, he didn't sound like a monster at all, did he?
He didn't. And, you know, I was lucky enough to spend a few days after filming our documentary with him and working on the interview that I've been trying to get for 12 years. And what we saw in that brief public appearance is really the way he was over the next few days as well.
Now, Khadr is living in Edmonton with his lawyer's family. He's out on bail. What kind of life does he have now and ahead of him, I guess?
You know, that's the really remarkable part of the story, how his lawyer has become such an important figure in his life. And as the lawyer's co-counsel said during the bail hearing, it's pretty uncommon for a lawyer to accept somebody into their home like this. He's got a pretty amazing life there. A few days after we left, he went with his lawyer to their vacation home. He's got a bike now. They're trying to just get him acclimatized to life on the outside. And the greater Edmonton community has really been supportive as well. He's got admission to a Christian university that he hopes to attend in the fall.
There's an incredible scene in your article where two local police officers come by, and I expect them to tell him to keep in line or something. And in fact, they're just introducing themselves and, yeah, and saying, essentially, if you need anything, we're here for you.
Yeah, we had a good laugh after that, to be honest, because it was such a stereotypically Canadian scene. We were actually interviewing him on camera at that point, and Omar kind of looked out the window and said, oh, the police are here, the police are here. They're going to want me to, you know, report in. And that was sort of one of the only little glimpses I had of him as somebody who's been institutionalized for a while. I mean, you could just sort of see that fear.
After I realized that they weren't there to sort of make threats, my next thought was that he's probably threatened, right? I mean, many people do consider him to be a terrorist, to still,
yes,
be a terrorist, despite what the courts say and despite what he says. Does he feel like he's in any danger? And do you think maybe the cops came by just to let him know that they're there for him if he has trouble?
They did. I mean, they came by to check in. He is on bail, so he has certain conditions. He has a curfew of 10 p.m. He has to wear an electronic monitoring bracelet. And my understanding with that is it's kind of a two-way. So it's to monitor him, but if he has any troubles, he can also activate it.
Khadr is from what you have referred to or people refer to as Canada's first family of terrorists. His dad is alleged to be friendly with, if not a member of, Al-Qaeda. Does he think he'll ever shake that label?
It'll be hard in Canada. His family has been notorious here pretty much since a previous documentary, actually back in 2004, where his mother and his sister said things on camera that really offended Canadians, and the allegations about his father being an Al-Qaeda financier were revealed. His father has since been killed, or he was killed actually the year before in 2003 in Pakistan. But definitely that is the way many Canadians look at him as part of this family. But I think he's gone a long way since being released to distancing himself from their views. And I think he has separated himself, but he'll always be known as a Khadr, and in Canada anyway, that's a famous name.
Michelle Shepherd of the Toronto Star. She co-produced a documentary about Omar Khadr with the CBC. The film scheduled to air here in the U.S. June 7th on Al Jazeera America. Our next story is also about a documentary film, one that's been remade now into a graphic novel. It's called Mike's Place, and it's by filmmaker and journalist Jack Baxter. In April 2003, he headed to Israel to make a film about Palestinian leader Marwan Barghouti. He was due to go on trial in Tel Aviv for terrorism charges. But when Baxter got to the courthouse, he discovered that a group of Israeli filmmakers were already doing that. Discouraged, he figured he'd go somewhere and cry into a beer. And that's when he discovered a blues bar in Tel Aviv called Mike's Place.
The special thing about Mike's Place, and that seemed like the allegory and the metaphor that that I could employ here, was that there were Israelis, Americans, Arabs, Europeans that were hanging out at the bar. And since it was right next door to the American Embassy on the Tel Aviv beachfront, and there were Marines in there, and, you know, it seemed like this was a perfect metaphor of what life could be like in an idealistic Middle East.
That idealism was shattered at one point when a suicide bomber attacked Mike's Place. You were right there when the explosion hit. What was that like? And I guess, how did you survive?
Well, a little after midnight on April 30th, 2003, I was outside the bar talking to my director. And right at that moment, as I was waiting to say goodbye to my fixer, driver, Avi Tabib, who was the bouncer at Mike's Place, a suicide bomber came up. And after yelling Allahu Akbar, he blew himself up. And the really interesting point of this is it was two people who actually were going to blow up Mike's Place. One succeeded. The other guy, who was standing about 30, 40 feet away, I guess when he had seen his compatriot detonate himself and saw what was going on, his bomb either malfunctioned or he decided that he didn't want to go through with it and dropped his bomb belt and ran away. Both of these individuals were not Palestinians. These were foreign nationals. They were out of Great Britain and had come into Israel and then eventually made their way to the Gaza Strip and then back into Tel Aviv. And this was the first time in the history of Israel that foreign nationals committed a suicide bombing.
And you did make a film about this. Why remake it now as a graphic novel? What does a graphic novel do that the film didn't or couldn't?
Well, it's a storyboard of what a film is, and you know, it can get more into the personalities and the bigger story, because the bigger story is that the ramifications of international terrorism showing its face and its terror in Tel Aviv is a subject that we couldn't really do in the documentary, but we can flesh out in this graphic novel.
I just have one question for you. I actually lived there in Jerusalem at the time that this happened in 2003. And I did not get down to Tel Aviv very much to go anywhere, whether to Mike's Place or anywhere else. But when I did get down to Tel Aviv, I was really scared, because in Jerusalem, things blew up a lot. And I was always shocked by the sort of laissez-faire-ness of Tel Aviv. And Mike's Place kind of exemplified that. And part of me feels, from reading the novel, that you guys were a little naive at the time about what was going on. It was a dangerous, dangerous time during the Intifada then.
You know, I guess we were naive to some extent. I remember Gal Gonsman and his brother Asaf Gonsman, who were the owners, co-owners of Mike's Place. And I remember that they had said to me, well, you know, nobody's going to attack Mike's Place because, you know, we're just a bunch of hippies here. And we really have nothing to do with the conflict. But in my estimation, the reason why it was attacked, especially the early morning hours of the day that the Quartet roadmap was being presented to the Palestinians and Israelis, is that it was meant to derail the roadmap for peace plan, put a serious crimp in that, and especially since it was right next door to the American Embassy, to send the United States a message that there is not going to be peace here. You know, those of us who are in the business of terrorism are going to derail this. So the naivete, yeah, I guess we did have some of that. But it was a hopeful time in one way that the roadmap would be presented and that maybe there was a chance for peace. Hmm. But it didn't work out like that, as we've seen.
Jack Baxter is the co-creator of the new graphic novel, Mike's Place. Jack, thank you so much for taking time out to speak with us.
Thank you.
Imagine if there were a Google Map program for sounds. There is, in a way. It's called Apari. It's an online audio archive where people upload field recordings from all across the globe. Apari now has almost 30,000 recordings. Sam Harnett has the story.
Let's just say you were in Kampala, Uganda in July 2010. You might have heard this. People beatboxing at a youth center. You're hearing this now because someone recorded it and uploaded it onto Apari. People have put all kinds of audio onto Apari since it launched in 2006. Here's a little sampling. It's Amakayaku National Park in the Amazon. And this is Beijing's central train station. Back in 2008, someone uploaded a recording from the Democratic Republic of Congo. It's a firefight between military and rebels.
Okay.
Apari was created by Berlin-based sound artist and programmer Udo Knoll. He did it mostly because, you know, it seemed cool to make a kind of living audio archive of the world. Now people can download the sounds, remix them, or take a little trip just by listening.
This gives a very rich experience of being somewhere or being at a certain place or how it may look like or how it may make feel like there, you know? So you have a kind of landscape which opens.
Anyone can contribute to Apari. There are sound artists like Jody Rose. She used contact microphones to make this recording of London's Millennial Bridge. But many contributors are just hobbyists, gathering sounds with inexpensive microphones, kind of amateur phonographers, like Carol Sidoriak.
You know, I've been recording a lot of creeks and birds chippering and waves gently, you know, waving or whatever, splashing.
Sidoriak is from the Czech Republic, but he lives in Berkeley, California. He records stuff he loves, like the creeks behind his house. Sounds you'd expect. But lately, he's been recording different kinds of things.
That is a nice sound, right?
A beer avalanche, Sidoriak calls it. He's recording sounds like this now, noises of our daily urban life, especially the ones that grate on him. Like at this recycling center he's taken me to.
This is kind of like a, you know, the guts of the urban environment of cities, really. And you got everything around here. Just look around and, you know, you can hear it too.
High on the terrible noise list are also automated telephone systems. So he records them too. And Home Depot's, the incessant background music and announcements.
Can I please have any available lumber construction associates at the Pro-Desk for customer assistance? Any available?
So, as you can probably tell, Sidoriak is sensitive to noise. Recording is a way to deal with it. He can concentrate on gathering the sounds instead of letting them drive him crazy.
It's just plain bad, you know. This sound environment that we spend a lot of time in, you know. Yeah.
Sidoriak thinks it's important to have audio on Apari that really shows the kind of soundscape many of us live in, even if it is annoying and unpleasant. So he puts his recordings on the map, and there they are, along with birds and creeks and waves, sounds many of us hear far less frequently than we would like to. For The World, I'm Sam Harnett, Berkeley.
Well, if it involves sound, the world definitely wants in. We just posted our own Sound of the World on Apari. Be sure to check it out. And if you upload your own sound, let us know on Twitter. We're at PRI The World, or tweet me at World Aaron. You're listening to The World.
Support for The World comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills like Hungarian, hula hooping, and HTML. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
I'm Aaron Schachter, and this is The World. Joey Alexander, as you can hear, plays the piano, and he's pretty darn good at it, too. Joey's scheduled to headline the Newport Jazz Festival this summer. He lives in New York, but he was born far removed from New York's swinging jazz scene on the Indonesian island of Bali. Joey, thanks so much for coming by to WGBH to play for us. Your debut album is called My Favorite Things. Just so we get to know you a little bit, Joey, besides the piano and, of course, Thelonious Monk, what are some of your favorite things?
Well, I like to do sports, like playing tennis, and sometimes I swim. And I like to do watch movies and, of course...
Just kind of kid stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. Our radio listeners, Joey, can probably detect in your voice that you're kind of young for... Becoming a world-famous musician. Tell me how old you are and how you got started.
Well, now I'm 11 years old.
11 years old?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I started playing piano when I was 6, but I already heard music before that when I was like a baby.
You remember hearing music when you were a baby?
Yeah, just, you know, I heard music and my dad, well, especially my dad introduced me to jazz. He always put me these CDs like Louis Armstrong, Thelonious Monk, Duke Ellington.
The early jazz greats here in America.
Yeah, the early records that I heard and all these other great musicians and, of course, Herbie Hancock. And
this was when you were growing up in Bali.
Yeah. And then I started to try this instrument, the piano. And I started to pick up some notes and follow the melody. That's how it started. When I was 7, I got serious.
Just a year later, when Joey was 8, he got to meet one of those jazz greats he mentioned, Herbie Hancock. He happened to be visiting Indonesia as a UNESCO Goodwill Ambassador. Hancock encouraged Joey to stick with it, and he did. Before too long, Joey was playing at international jazz competitions. He came in first at one in Ukraine. Then his performances caught the ear of another jazz great, trumpeter Wynton Marsalis, who invited Joey to play at Lincoln Center last year. Now the Newport Jazz gig this summer. And remember, Joey's still just 11 years old. Did you ever want to play other kind of music, or was it always just jazz?
I mean, I like pop music. You know, I heard Michael Jackson, James Brown, and the Beatles. And also, you could, you know, make it jazz.
You could make James Brown and the Beatles into jazz?
Yeah. I mean, like when I play Over the Rainbow and My Favorite Things.
Right, right.
Yeah, jazz is, you know, you could change... from other music to your own style and to make it jazz.
Okay, so you started getting serious at piano at 7 years old.
Yeah.
Did that just seem normal? Like something any kid might do?
I mean, for me, it's normal to me. Right, I don't think it's like... But I think for me, it's first gift from God that I could play jazz.
So you recognize it is a very special thing that you have. It is a gift.
Yeah. I mean, I know many people would say, you know, you're playing jazz. I mean, jazz is, you know, a grown-up thing. But, you know, I think jazz is for everyone. Even for kids, they could listen to jazz and enjoy it too.
So tell me how you got from getting serious at 7 years old to being famous not too many years later.
I wouldn't say famous, but...
You're pretty famous now.
I mean, for me, I just, you know, play.
Standard, My Favorite Things, which is the title of your new album, right? A song that didn't start out as jazz, but is now kind of a jazz standard.
Yeah, I first heard My Favorite Things when John Coltrane played this song. And it's from The Sound of Music, and I first heard it, I just, you know, loved the song. So, very special, and I tried to arrange this on the album.
I wish people could see how excited and into playing you are when you do this. And you make it look effortless. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's an honor. Thank you for having me here.
Joey Alexander playing My Favorite Things here at WGBH. Did I mention he's just 11? And if you don't believe it, we've got a video of his performance. You may not believe the video either. Anyway, it's at PRI.org. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH, I'm Aaron Schachter. Have a great weekend. Marco Werman is back on Monday.
Production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, brought to you by PRI's Global Reporting Fund, supporting its diverse reporting efforts, including ongoing global health coverage and its Across Women's Lives initiative. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman, the Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, Garrett and Cecilia Boone, and the Gruber Family Foundation. By the Skoll Foundation, supporting innovative solutions to the world's most pressing problems with the Skoll Award for Social Entrepreneurship. More information is available at SKOLL.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by the Ford Foundation, by the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Noor Hall, and by the National Endowment for the Arts.
PRI, Public Radio International.